Jason, we friends just having a conversation.
Wave your hands high.
Don't stop.
Wave your hands high.
All right, welcome back. We've got another episode. I'm glad that y'all are joining in and having some fun with this. Don't forget that this premieres on Deep Ellum Radio on Tuesdays and Fridays, and then it goes live to stream on Amazon Music the following Monday. So wherever you're listening, I truly appreciate it. I also appreciate everybody on Instagram. Follow us there. I'm going to try to put more content up there as I can. And then, of course, everyone who's joined Patreon. It's just wonderful to see people supporting, people invested, people excited. We have a $3 level. So if you can afford $3 a month, that's what's keeping this show going. Enough about that. We will kick right into the show now. We've got somebody here who's been a big part of the North Texas music scene for a long time, both in bands and other ventures. So let's say hello to G.I. Sanders.
How are you?
I'm doing well. So we're out here in, what is this, Little Elm?
Highland Village,
that's right.
Even further.
I was surprised coming out here because, you know, I looked it up on the GPS and I didn't realize you're only like a couple miles from where my dad lives. So I'm familiar with the area. And as a matter of fact, if you didn't know this, one of the Bowling for Soup album covers was shot just a couple miles from here.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, yeah. That's very cool. I knew Jarrett lived out here.
He sure did.
We're very close by until he moved over to your side of town.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So yeah, there's some music connections over here, definitely.
Absolutely.
Well, speaking about music connections, let's find out kind of your connection to North Texas music. The most obvious is going to be South FM. Yeah,
absolutely.
Is that kind of where you kicked off in the North Texas music scene, or did you have other stuff before that?
So prior to South FM, which that was a band that I formed and was a part of, I guess it was 99 when we officially got together. Prior to that, I was just in the audience, you know?
Yeah.
Trees, Ricks, Clearview, all those types of things. Bands like, you know, Tripping Daisy and Hagfish and Reverend Horton Heat and all of those kind of early 90s Dallas kind of alternative bands, Toadies, of course, they were my start getting to see those bands and realize that, oh my God, these are just other local guys. That was the, you know, it's kind of cliche, but you're like, oh my God, I think I can do that. And so after watching bands locally in clubs for, you know, probably 5-7 years, very consistently, finally got enough confidence, I guess you could say, as a musician, because I was just kind of learning how to play all those years, to like kind of get a little group together and start doing the thing. So yeah, and then South FM took over at that point. And I did that for, I think maybe we did that for 7 or 8 years, which was great, from 99 to kind of 2006, 2007. So it's crazy looking back now how small of part of it was, but it was so meaningful at the time, getting to be in that band culture and getting to be on stage, getting to tour, you know, record all those things that I can't say I really dreamed of doing up until, again, I understood that there was a local scene that you could be a part of, and that just kind of changed everything.
Yeah, well, you say a small part, but I mean, you were signed to, it was MCA, right?
MCA, yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, most of these bands would consider that to be much, much bigger accomplishment than they ever achieved. I mean, how does that happen?
We were very fortunate. I will say, it's a short way of answering that is, our primary songwriter Paco Estrada, who's a very established musician in the local area, he was our front man and again songwriter in South of M. So first and foremost, without his songs and his talent, none of it happened. So that's beyond. I was more, and I played guitar in the band and was proficient as a guitar player, but I think even more so I was proficient as a band dad, more or less. Like, there's always someone in,
somebody's got to wrangle them.
Someone's got to like schedule practices and figure all the boring logistic parts out. So that was me, which I enjoyed a lot of that. So I was kind of the manager within the band, on the small level. And then to answer your question, how do we end up on MCA Records? Well, a lot of that had to do with time and place, and meeting the right people locally. So we made a conscious decision at that time, which was like, around 2000, 2001, we were living in the suburbs out here in Louisville area, also in Carrollton. And I said, man, if we're going to give a run at this, we've got to live downtown. We have to be downtown. And so we made that leap, and that enabled us to be in Curtain Club and Trees and Clearview and all those clubs on a nightly basis to make the connections to find real management, which was Rainmaker Artist, who had already had success with the Nixons and Deep Blue Something and started, you know, had a whole career built out of those, and still to this day with Bowling for Soup and Blue October still active. But we connected with those guys, with Mike Swinford and Paul Nugent, and that was the conduit to get us to MCA, which was around 2002-2003. Which was a huge accomplishment. We put our first record out locally through those guys, and then got the MCA deal signed, and they kind of re-released that first record.
Yeah, which I found happens quite a bit. When somebody's got a really strong album, either they'll simply just tweak it.
That was a big selling point.
Mix it, and yeah.
Big selling point. They were like, this is ready to go. All we have to do is slap our logo on it and get it into distribution channels and get it on radio and all that. So it was a whirlwind. Again, like looking back, we were signed and dropped within 18 months, I think. You know,
I've read some of your posts on Facebook about how you got paid well, and you don't think they ever made any of that back.
Oh, there's no way they did. No, what happened was, and in hindsight, it's funny looking back on all this stuff, but our A&R guy, the guy who kind of quote-unquote discovered us, signed us at MCA, he told us after the fact, he said he knew that we were A, his last signing, and that B, the label was on the cusp of going down. And so he was like, man, I was really trying to get you guys in there to get a hit song to be my last kind of thing, which, you know, which was really cool. And in short, basically, at that time, the whole music industry was just getting totally eaten up. MCA merged with Geffen. And I think there was only a handful of artists that made that leap from MCA Geffen. It was like Blink-182, Mary J. Blige. It was like the top tier, international artists. Everyone else, little guys like South of M and so many other kind of developing artists all got dropped. It was a very exciting time, and I'm so glad it happened. But it was rough at the time too, because we were very excited to be at that level. And then now we're just back to being a local band again.
I get it. I saw that with a few bands. I want to say that, was Bob Goblin on MCA as well?
Yes. Yep.
And their story, from what I understand, because I was friends with Jason Weisenberg, and he had said kind of similar stuff where, you know, they came in and they paid well and they promised a lot, but kind of behind the scenes, there was absolutely no traction. And then, like you said, the whole industry was starting to change.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of great bands that had just amazing music got caught up in that whole mess.
Yeah, it was a very hard time to be in the music industry. Honestly, our kind of record deal and everything was right on the cusp of, like, within months after the time we got signed, and by the time we even got dropped, like, record label advances, I mean, were chopped in, not like half, like in a tenth. Like, you used to get a couple hundred grand, and then overnight, because of Napster and then iTunes and the whole digital revolution, like everything just got completely reorged to where it just didn't work that way. When we were on the very tail end of that, which again, we were lucky to be, because we had like tour support. They bought us a van. Like, this was school music industry stuff. You know, that stuff doesn't happen by 2005 even. Everything had changed, and advances had just gotten completely chopped. So again, very thankful for time and place that we had that opportunity, even though it was short-lived. Like you said, most bands don't even get that shot. And so at least we had a shot, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So I saw the exact same thing with the album covers that I photographed. I started out where somebody like Jive would pay $7,500, $10,000, and then the next album they're like, well, we've only got $5,000 for this one. And then you do the third album and it's like, well, we got $1,500. And it's you have to wonder where all the money went, because there was still money out there. There
was
still
records in somebody's pockets. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so let me ask you more about the band on a day-to-day basis. You said that you made the conscious effort to put yourself down in Deep Ellum on a daily basis, so that you got to meet people, you got to promote the band in a more organic way.
Oh yeah.
I've got to imagine that you met a lot of really good friends that way.
Lifelong friends.
It was a scene.
It really was a scene. And getting, it was crazy for me, honestly. And still looking back on it, still crazy. Hell, even sitting here talking to you, man. Like, I remember for so many years, from pretty much like 91, 92, up until I joined South FM, or started South FM in like 98-ish. For those years, like, I was living through liner notes. So seeing who shot the album covers, seeing who managed the bands, produced the bands, what labels were they on. So I'm talking like Dragon Street and Last Beat and all these things. And of course, One Ton. So then you fast forward to basically about 10 years later, late 90s, living in Deep Elm, getting to meet a lot of these people because they're still around and there still is a scene, and then getting to become friends and still lifelong friends with so many of those people. It's very surreal. And I was, again, thankful for the opportunity, but now, I know, and especially now as we segue into what I'm doing now, like making even more connections with these people, people that I knew the names of for years, from reading liner notes, and now to be able to just be in regular conversations with them and work with them on albums and things like that. It's been really, really cool.
Oh yeah, no doubt. I mean, as a photographer, I had a very similar thing where, you know, I'd pick up the Met and I'd see Nancy Newberry's name in there, and I'd pick up the Observer and see Mark Graham. And then, I know that Alison Smith was doing a lot of local music, and, you know, James Bland and all these photographers are like, oh, I want to be a part of that scene.
Yeah.
There's something wonderful about having that tangible aspect, and you as a fan connecting through that touch of that album or that review, and then you go down there and immerse yourself in the scene. It's hard to imagine how you can have that same excitement when you simply stream the newest album.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I think musicians today in general are just in such a tougher spot. You know, I mean, yes, the accessibility to be able to get to record your music, to get your music out there, like there's an aspect of that that is easier. But in regards to the ability for a scene to form, it's got to be really, really hard. And again, just so thankful that we were in the thick of that on the tail end of the analog nostalgic era before digital took over, before social media and everything went into the phone in our pocket. You know, thankfully, we were at a very impressionable age and got to experience that. I mean, it's why I'm sitting here today and why I do what I do today, because of that whole period from the time we were, you know, high school age through end of college age, like very, very ripe for influence. And again, right place and right time. And Dallas was just so great. Like, there was such a great, and there's still obviously lots of scene aspects to the local music scene going on today and thriving, but not to what it was there, to where it was.
Well, sure. You've still got located. You know, Three Links plays a lot of local bands. Trees will still have local band nights. Mm-hmm. There's still a good scene down there.
Absolutely.
I definitely don't want to knock that.
I think as far as the scope of it, it just, I don't know how it can compare because times have simply changed.
Yeah,
you know, definitely. That's all there is to it, you know?
Sure. It's like if I watch American Graffiti, the movie, and you think about the time when everybody tuned into AM radio to listen to Wolfman Jack, and everyone was connected through this kind of center source.
Yep.
And that's the way I view the 90s, and I'd say part of the 2000s.
Early 2000s,
Of Deep Elm, is it seemed like it was this center source. Deep Elm was that Wolfman Jack that was drawing everyone in together to have a shared experience.
Yeah. Well, and it was like, as a fan, like, you waited for Wednesdays for the Observer to come out.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was, I mean, then you're, I mean, scouring the Observer, seeing who was playing 2 days later. You know, because you didn't know otherwise. I mean, there was no way to find out, obviously.
So, well, and you had somebody like Zach Crane who, you know, he wrote about so many great bands that I don't think I would have discovered if I hadn't picked up the Observer. And all of a sudden I'm reading, and then he's like, you know, hey, there's Moss Isley, which eventually came Isley. I discovered them through Zach.
Totally.
You know, I became fans of certain bands through Zach.
Yeah, I mean, well, it was Zach and the Observer. It was obviously, you know, Adventure Club, Josh, and certainly George Gamark and On the Edge and their support of local media. Like there were, I don't want to say gatekeepers, but like there were stakeholders. That's a better word of like legit conduits at that time to where you depended on these people, these publications to learn what was going on. And so they were your starting points to kind of navigate things, especially as a kid who at that point, you know, I was, you know, 16, 17 years old in high school trying to figure out how to get to Deep Elm on a Wednesday to see some obscure band.
Sure,
that, you know, like it was good times.
No, I almost threw out the word gatekeeper, but I held it back because even though it is true in a way, it doesn't fit the spirit of what they were doing. The only reason it's a gatekeeper is because back then internet was so new. There wasn't really all the ways to experience the way you can now.
Mm-hmm.
You had to go to something like The Observer or The Met or Harder Beat to find out what was new.
Buddy Magazine.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And Buddy. Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
A lot of that was more musician focused. But yeah, I mean, it was a weekly ritual to look through the pages of all those. And then as I got into like getting into becoming a musician and wanting to form a band, then it was all about the classifieds, you know, trying to figure out like who was available. Like, how do you find a rehearsal space, a recording studio, a mastering studio? I found all of those from the back of the Observer, Buddy Magazine initially, like, and you would cold call recording studios to be like, so I got a band, how do I do this?
Yeah, you know? Yeah, no, 100%.
Do you have like the right equipment? Like, yeah.
You'd see ads for Crystal Clear. And
ended up connecting with that whole, the Crystal Clear family, Sam Paulus and Mike Swinford and Jim Cock, and like all these people, Paul Nugent, Dale Brock, everyone that kind of ushered not only South of Fem's career, but in a lot of ways, my own personal career, because I worked with and for all of those people and still do in a lot of ways, which is crazy, 25 years later. So yeah, again, a lot of time and place and a lot of just appreciation for being at that time and place.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I knew this would happen because coming in, I was like, we're going to blow past our times. I know that we're going to start talking and I'm going to forget all about playing a song. So I think... let's go ahead, take a quick break, and what do you think about hearing some South FM?
Let's do it, man.
All right, let's do that.
You cannot hear what I am saying. You push your words inside my mouth. You make this harder than it has to be. You make this harder on yourself. Myself a new direction, but every path leads back to you. And when we look into the mirror, you will not see the
is killing me. I don't wanna waste more time telling you how I feel.
All right, well, that was some pretty good stuff. Let me ask you real quick, because I know we discussed some of the people that you got to know in the scene when you were in the band, mm-hmm. but we didn't discuss specifically who you were playing with.
Oh, sure.
Who'd you share the bill with?
As far as other bands and that type of thing? Yeah, so the early, let's see, if I think back to the earliest days of South FM, there were bands like Spoonfed Tribe.
Sure, yeah.
Which is a totally experimental outside the box genre wise band, but somehow we connected with those guys and it made sense. So we did a lot of shows with them all over Texas. We played with a lot of kind of similar style kind of alternative rock bands like Edgewater. We played a lot of shows with Blue October, who were still kind of a local regional band at that time. And then we went on to play with lots of bands that I ended up I first started off seeing like Slow Roosevelt and Dusu and those, kind of that one ton scene, which again, I was a huge fan of. So the fact that I was then getting to share bills with them and play opening slots to some of their shows, that was a really, really cool thing. It was that era again, late 90s, early 2000s. So the era of Toadies, Daisy, Course of Empire, Rev, Hagfish was coming to a close a little bit. Like some of those bands were still around, but as far as them being local and playing, you know, weekly, bi-weekly shows in the clubs, like they had kind of all gotten signed and moved on or broken up or whatever it may be. So we were kind of that second wave, I guess you could say, of that kind of the tail end of, I think, that true Deep Ellum scene. I mean, again, it still exists today, but if I put an end cap on it, I'd say like early mid 2000s is when it was kind of like, you know, tides were shifting, you know.
Oh yeah, no, 100%. You had Tripping Daisy went away when Wes died,
of course.
You'd see just a little bit of Toadies here and there because they were in their hiatus.
Yeah,
they did put that on the side and did Burton Brothers.
Yep. And we did a lot of shows with them. Yeah, with Burton Brothers. And
do you ever play with Advent?
I'm sure we shared some bills with them at Curtain Club. You know, bands like Advent, Big Iron, Down Low, all, you know, the heavier kind of Porn Lab and like all those like heavy bands that, because again, Curtain Club is kind of known for that heavy side of things. So yeah, shared a lot of bills with those types of bands.
That makes sense. And I mean, you mentioned getting a tour van, so I have to imagine you spent some time outside of North Texas. Where all do you remember playing?
Yeah, so most of where we did kind of, I guess if you look at South FM's career from 99 to 2006-ish, I would say three or four of those years were like legit weekend warrior stuff, meaning you're only going out for 3-4 shows at a time max, which means you're only going Texas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, so really regionally based stuff when you can only tour weekends, because then you got to get back home to get to work on Monday.
Sure.
So there was a large portion before and after we were signed where that was the contingency as far as locations concerned. But the period where we were signed and we had tour support because we were on MCA, which was about 2 years, let's say, we were playing all over the U.S., but primarily in the southern, southeastern area. So a lot of shows in Florida, Alabama, Arkansas, like all that, and then up the East Coast. And the reasoning behind all that was just radio play. Because, again, this is still pre-complete Clear Channel takeover, which means there were still radio DJs who could play undiscovered artists and like kind of up and coming artists and that type of thing. And so we would follow radio play. So if there was a station in New Jersey, which there was, playing South FM, we would be routing ourselves to New Jersey to support the single that they were spinning. And so we would end up with some weird routing, but you would essentially follow whoever was adding your song. You would then try and get a local date, and you would try and work with the radio station, of course, to do something, which was a lot of times very helpful. But even in lieu of that, you would still chase that around. So yeah, we got to play not the whole country, but a large portion of it, which was very cool.
Well, I imagine so. I know when we talked with Gary, he mentioned how they used to go out and do the radio circuit.
Festivals. We did lots of festivals. Yeah.
It's got to be not only a lot of effort, but a lot of reward, I would imagine.
The work involved with touring, especially in a van, is substantial, because not so much because the van's a bad ride. We had a brand new 12-passenger van, but you can only fit the guys in the band plus really one or two other guys, which means we're humping all our own gear. You know, we barely had roadies. We had a road manager who doubled as our sound guy, who doubled as our drum tech, and then we had one guitar tech who handled all the guitars and the bass, you know. So it's like maybe we had two guys helping us when we were really well off, which means there's just not a lot of room, there's not a lot of space, and you're doing a lot of the work yourself. You know, we were right on the cusp of where if we would have been able to check a few more boxes from a success standpoint, we maybe would have got to a bus, which was like going to be really cool. But then it all fell apart That would have been cool. But van touring is hard work, man. It really is.
Well, so like you said, you know, it eventually fell apart. And I mean, that was a story for a lot of North Texas bands. And it was a sign of that time. You did not start another band. You kind of moved on, right?
I did. I had, you know, we put out a second record, which just came out locally on Brando Records, which was tied in with our management, Rainmaker. The first record came out there, but then it got, you know, picked up by MCA. So then we're back on our own. We got to write our second record. And it's like the old adage says, it's like you got your whole life to write your first record. You're lucky if you get 12 months to write your second. And for us, that held true. The second record, actually, I think we wrote for about 2 years. And we're still doing sporadic, you know, shows during that time. But by and large, we were just cooped up in rehearsal space. Put the second record out locally, which was a far better record, called Swallowing the Pill. Fabulous record that I'm super proud of. And then we quote unquote toured on that for basically, I don't know, 2 years. But again, that was all regional touring, because we didn't have the money to be able to go tour elsewhere. And we didn't have radio support other than regionally. And
You did the thing that a whole lot of bands do. You go down to Austin, you go down to San Antonio, yes. You go to Houston, you go out west.
Yeah. Tons of shows in West Texas, Odessa, and yeah. Lubbock, and college towns galore, Abilene.
Yeah,
and
College Station.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, we did that circuit again for like 2 years on that second record, and then we just couldn't crack the nut. And mainly it wasn't because the songs weren't great. It wasn't because our management wasn't working their ass off or in the label and all that. The whole industry had just changed. You know, we're talking about 2006 now, 2005, 2006. And so for me personally, I was like, man, I just can't see how we're going to get back to making a legit career out of this. And at that point, me personally, I'd gotten married right in the middle of that. I got married while we were signed in 2003, and we were starting to think about having kids. And I was just like, man, I don't know if I can do this again. And so, yeah, so I hung it up. I really, people ask me all the time, they're like, do you still play? And I'm like, there's a guitar sitting right behind you there. And that's the extent of me playing. It's just picking up a guitar every now and then. I of course I miss it, but I mean, I had my shot. I had my fill of it, and I had a much greater, how should I say? I got to see a whole scope of things, you know, as far as the industry was concerned, and got to record in studios all over, work with real producers, and just, you know, I got to see all sides of it, and I was very thankful that, and kind of just got that point where I think I'm good. I think I need to figure out something else now, you know?
Which you did. And I mean, you were still in the industry in a way, because you've got a pretty big community centered around your vinyl. Is empire the right word? Because it sure seems big. It might not seem Josie big, but I mean you've got a huge following for your business. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, so NTX Vinyl or North Texas Vinyl, talk about a throwback. So I've been at it for about I think I started in 2019. And essentially, it was an extension of me being a record collector for years and years and years. Like, I was the kid in Bills in 1993 when Tripping Daisy was released in Firecracker. And, yeah. You know, like, I was there. I know you were there, too.
Yeah, did you go to the Bills birthday with the Tripping Daisy set up out in the parking lot?
Yes.
And they did that. The nice thing about it, even though this is pre-internet, uh-huh. is people still brought like their video cameras.
I can't believe you can watch it.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable.
It's crazy that was captured because those special events at Bill's were just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and so that's really at the root of when I was like, man, it's. I mean, of course, I'm buying CDs then. Because you got to take them, you want to take them in your car, sure. and your discman, all that. But for records, I really loved. Like I was always really attracted to the vinyl, and still am. And that's where it all kind of started. So then, in long story short, in 2019, I had gotten to a point where I was speaking of Josie. I was going down to Josie once a month, and for a couple of years. Just so thankful that we had such a badass record store in town. And I was going down and dropping a couple hundred dollars a month. You know, like a lot of people are. And after a long while of that, I got to the point where I was like, this isn't very sustainable anymore. Like, I don't know how I'm going to continue this. And that's when I started shifting my mentality a little bit and going, maybe I could go buy like collections, right? And that's really where NTX Vinyl started, because once I got that bug of buying in bulk and then, you know, buying a couple hundred records, keeping the ones I want, turning around. And this is like when Facebook Marketplace was actually useful and it wasn't like just like a mess like it is kind of these days. You could go out and buy collections, small or large, you know, a couple hundred records, that type of thing. And you could turn around and make a few bucks and keep records. Long story short, my collection started to really expand and I started to get in a business mindset of like, wow, I can see how this can kind of work. And, you know, I'm not new to this. There's people been doing it for years and years. But for me, I was like, this is interesting. And I had been working a corporate job, doing digital marketing of all shapes and sizes and forms for many years. And so I kind of started to go, well, if I turned this record thing into a business, I know I can apply everything I've learned in the corporate world, from a video production, from a thought leadership, from an educational perspective, from a marketing perspective, branding, all the things that I've been doing in the corporate kind of startup world for basically about 15 plus years. I kind of married the two. I married my love of music and vinyl with all of everything I had learned in regards to how to promote and market something, which again, started way back in South FM too, because I was doing all that too. And so that's where it really kind of came to a head right around the time of COVID, 2020, 2021 is when NTX Vinyl kind of, I guess you could say, started to really get some momentum to it, you know.
Sure. No, that makes sense. That was definitely a tipping point for vinyl. I know I got in it the same way that you did, where, you know, I had my records as a kid, then I went to CDs, and then around like 98 I got back into vinyl, and my collection slowly grew and grew and grew until I realized, hey, I'm buying some of these like $200 and $300 lots to get five, and then I got to figure out what to do with the rest of it. And so, you know, for several years, I did like the flea markets.
Yep.
Then I eventually went into a couple antique malls. And right around 2018, you started to see a real shift, 19, 20. Yep. And then right as COVID hit right there,
yep.
It just completely changed the market.
It really did. It was, in hindsight now, it's easy to look back on it and go, oh, wow, yeah. But when you're in the middle of it, you're like, it just feels like it's on fire. And it was. Yeah. And it was legit the perfect storm. Like it wasn't a lot of industries. But when you want to talk about FOMO, fear of missing out, 2021 vinyl, because pressing plants shut down and you just couldn't get all these standard albums. And then you had all these people who legit just started collecting, or they're stuck at home. So they're, you know, rediscovering.
Or their work changed, and so now they're working from home.
They're spending time at home, yeah.
Put on a record, Play it while you work.
Yeah. Totally. And it just created this environment to where people are like, why can't I get this Smashing Pumpkins record or this Beatles record or whatever it may be? And in a lot of cases, it was just because people were impatient and pressing plants were shut down or severely slowed down. And so the whole industry got impacted. And now we're on the backside of that. And so it's, again, easy to look at it now and kind of see what was happening. But in the midst of it, it was very, very interesting to be involved in it and seeing what was going on because it was a little crazy.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, we're about time for our next break. Let's see. So we discussed a little bit earlier how you went out on tour with several bands. We discussed a few of the bands that were influences of yours that you eventually got to share the stage with. Let's see, we talked about Toadies, we talked about Slow Row, we talked about Edgewater. Who's a band that you remember from that era that you got to share a stage with that you think we should listen to now?
If there's one, if you would say, talk about influence, for me personally, one of the biggest reasons I ever picked up a guitar because I realized it was very accessible was Dusu.
Oh, yeah.
Dusu was a band. I had some mutual friends that knew them very well. And so I was seeing them in the very early days when they were playing community halls and like not even venues yet, like that type of thing. And so, yeah, let's play some Dusu because I'm now great friends with all those guys and did get to share the stage with them. But they were very much one of the reasons why I picked up a guitar.
I think that's a great idea. Our listeners who listen to every episode are probably not surprised that you said that because Dusu gets mentioned in most of the episodes.
I love it.
For a band to have that much influence on so many people, I think says a lot. And so I see nothing wrong with playing a little more Dusu on our show. Here we go.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that was great. I can never get enough of, you know, Casey and Chad and just the entire band and what they've given to the scene is just so impressive. And I've known Casey for a long time. I shot two of the Dusu members' weddings.
Nice.
I shot one of their promo photos. I did several album reviews over the years and shot them live. I don't think I can even count how many times. They're just a great band.
And those shows at Fry Street Fair.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So good.
I've got a shot of Casey's classic backward bend you're like, that dude will win every limbo competition.
I totally ripped that off, too, for years. Years after that, I was doing that shit.
And so the cool thing about playing them is we can segue into something very impressive that you do for the scene currently. You put out a Dusu album on vinyl. Was it ever on vinyl originally? Was this the first release on vinyl for it?
No, yeah. So we've put out two Dusu records, Aqua Vita, which was their second full length. And then we put out the EP after that, Quick Bionic Arms, on the label DFW Legacy Series.
Yeah, so tell us about this label, because this is impressive.
Yeah, man. So again, very much time and place because of COVID. Myself and a couple buddies, we had the idea to go back in time to a bunch of albums, local albums that had never been on vinyl, because again, we're talking about, you know, early to mid 90s through basically mid 2000s, which are pretty much the dark days of vinyl, because CD has taken over. Even major label stuff isn't even getting put to vinyl, and if it is, it's very limited. It's very hard to find during that period. So local artists, like, I don't remember hardly any, like maybe Tripping Daisy and Toadies, like the top tier.
Not even Tripping Daisy, because Tripping Daisy, who was signed to Island, a major label, and Tim had produced a small amount of Firecracker on vinyl, and that was super hard to find because it wasn't ever released in stores, I don't think. It just was like something special he wanted to do.
Yeah.
I don't remember Toadies ever being released.
Yeah, I mean, it existed, but they were so limited, and no one sold them other than like Bills, but even then it was very limited to try and get. So yeah, so none of those albums from that era of Dallas music, for the most part, have ever been on vinyl. So we, during COVID, as I got North Texas Vinyl up and going, we had the idea of like, well, what would it look like if we went back and tried to bring some of those basically albums that were only on CD to vinyl? And that was the genesis of the idea. And here we are 2.5 years later, and we've put out 27 records, which have all first time on vinyl, all limited edition, usually between 200-300 copies. Some have been a little more, some a little less, but bands like Dusu and Slow Roosevelt, Edgewater, a lot of these bands we're mentioning.
Flickerstick.
Flickerstick.
That Flickerstick one blew up.
Fantastic. Absolutely.
I got to imagine that thing must have sold out in seconds.
That was the big one. That was, I think we sold out 600 copies in a few days. And that was a beautiful story because the band hadn't been even in touch for many years. Their fan base had remained very engaged and active, like via just a Facebook group who was always prodding them to get back together. But us putting that record out was actually the start of that band getting back together and performing and now writing and recording again, which is amazing. So that things like that have happened throughout the journey of DFW Legacy Series that have just been so incredible to see from afar and from being inside of it. We've done a bunch of stuff for charities. We've worked with Josh Venable. We did an Adventure Club compilation.
That's right, yeah.
So yeah, it's just been amazing, just blanking on the number of the bands that we've worked with. But yeah, an incredible roster. Hagfish, we put out Hagfish's Buick Men record, the first one, which was on Dragon Street. The Nixon Six first EP, which was on Dragon Street.
Baboon.
So, Baboon, We Sing and Play. And
which that also was very special. It might not have been on the same level as Flicker Stick, mm-hmm. but for Baboon fans, that was a difficult album to find even on CD.
Yes. And I remember, I have so many ties to so many of those albums, either as a fan or musician. That one, and specifically We Sing and Play, I remember when South FM went in to record some initial demos, not one of our albums, but it was the first time we ever went into Crystal Clear Studios, because I knew from liner notes, I'm like, if we're going to make something, this is the studio we need to make it in, just because of the engineers that'll be working on it and the people that might get wind of it. Long story short is, I remember being in the studio with Kent Stump, who was the main engineer at Crystal Clear for many, many years. And we were recording a track, again, kind of demo stuff. And Baboon had just recorded We Sing and Play. And I was talking with Kent Stump, and he was telling me, oh, Baboon was just in here last week. They had just used this organ on a handful of songs, and we put that organ on specifically because Baboon had just used it.
Yeah.
I was like, we got to put that on a track, you know, cool stuff like that. But yeah, so getting to, again, great example, Baboon, of a band I've seen so many times but never knew personally until DFW Legacy Series, and I was able to connect with all these people, the guys in Course of Empire and Ugly Mustard, and like all these bands that I've seen as a fan. I kind of know of them from being in the scene, but I wasn't friends with all these people. But now I know so many of them personally, and I'm in contact because of the label and because of this vinyl reissue kind of project we've done. So it's just been, I mean, it's a true labor of love. They're all limited edition. We're not making a bunch of money off this stuff. It's all about just keeping the music alive, like 100%.
Yeah, I'd have to say it's got to be more about the love of the music, because I know I've talked with Irv at Idol several times, and I was like, you know, have you thought about kind of catching this vinyl wave and re-releasing some stuff on vinyl? And, you know, each time he's like, man, I'd love to. But when you really sit down and look at the numbers, it's going to be a zero-sum game.
It is.
It's going to be a lot of work.
That's exactly what it is.
And none of these bands will actually make anything off of it. Mm-mm. And so I'd love to, and luckily, you're the guy who's coming out and saying, hey, I'd love to, and I am going to.
Yeah. The reality is, unless you can sell, I mean, at least 500, but that's even on the low, low end. Unless you can sell, you know, 500 or more records, you're really not making any money, because vinyl just costs a lot of money to make, not only from an actual hard cost of manufacturing, but then the cost of doing the art and sourcing the audio and getting it remastered. There's so many steps to go through. I mean, I say it a million times, it's a true labor of love, the DFW Legacy Series, and by far and large, the reason why it exists is because we want these albums to have a second life. And by that, I mean, I want them sitting on my shelf.
Yeah.
Like, that was literally the point where, like, we should do this album. Why? Because I want it. Like, and if I don't do it, it'll never exist otherwise. Like, that's the legit conversation that goes into each one of our releases, you know? And some of them are selfish. We're like, honestly, kind of the Baboon record is a little selfish. Like, there's a bunch of good Baboon records we could have done. People were asking for other ones. But that EP was just very special for me personally, time and place. And so I was like, and we may do some more in the future, but that one was one I just really wanted.
That was such a golden record,
it
too.
Was. So it was like six tracks, a little EP, Lush Life and Rise, some great songs.
I look at, because I know you don't do CDs.
I
do CDs. I've got, you know, my collection probably similar in size to yours, vinyl, and then I've got the same size in CDs, because I've always loved CDs. I just happen to be at the right place at the right time when CDs were coming up.
Yep.
And I look at my collection of Texas music on CDs, and I realize so much of this stuff, it would be so hard to find because it's not on iTunes.
No, yeah, it's not streaming.
You can't find it on Spotify.
Maybe YouTube.
A couple of the bands still have some of the stuff up on Bandcamp.
Oh, yeah.
But the idea that this beautiful music, this great art is not available if you want it. It's just, it's a crime.
It is. And for us, the physicality of the format and how beautiful a record can be and how tangible it is and the ownership of it on a shelf, like that, all of that aspect really speaks to, I think, a lot of people. I mean, we're full circle. People our age now, like, you can't discount nostalgia. I mean, it's part of the reason why we're sitting here talking about the era, you know, 25 years ago, is because it was so meaningful to us and the music that was created during that period. And again, that's the DFW Legacy Series, just trying to keep it alive, give it a second life, you know. And again, we're talking about a couple hundred people who really remember and love those bands and also collect records and also have $30, $40, $50 to spend on one record. Like, that's a small group. And it's the definition of niche. Like, that is a small niche. And that's really, to your point about Irv, like, that's what you're keying in on. So when it's that small, it's not like this is going to be a big moneymaker. But again, if you can sell a couple hundred copies, you can break even on something. And that's our goal has always been, as long as we don't lose money and we get to add these records to our collection, we'll do it as long as we can, as long as we can sustain it. And, you know, again, we're here, we're 27 records in and still doing it. So it is getting harder as we get busier and that type of thing. But we're still very optimistic to keep it going.
Sure. Yeah. And you've got some other stuff coming up, because I know Eric and I are friends, and he said, I want to let you know Ugly Mustard's on its way. We've got some of your photos in there in the gatefold.
It is. It is. Ugly Mustard is on its way. As the moment where we're talking right now, late January, we just got those in and they're going to be shipping. That's our latest release. I think that is the 27th title in the series. And then we've got, I want to say, at least three or four others that are kind of in various stages of production already. Some from bands we've already mentioned here today. Some from bands we've put stuff out before, working on completing their catalogs, and then others that we haven't worked on at all. So there's still tons more for the taking. It's just a matter of us checking them off the list and getting to them, you know?
Let me ask you this, because I don't want to give away any secrets of stuff that's actually in the works. Mm-hmm. So instead, why don't we discuss this? If it was just possible for you to go out and kind of magically Willy Wonka whatever album in the world that you wanted to put out on the label, what are some of the dream albums that you would go after?
Oh man, that's a hard one. We've done a few of them. Course of Empires Initiation was one of them. That was one where I was like, you got to be kidding me. If I can be involved in putting that out. So that was definitely a dream album.
And that was a wonderful time to do that too, because of everything with Chad, and it was the perfect moment to release it that way.
We were very excited to be able to collaborate with Mike Graff and Michael Drome on that. That was awesome. So that was kind of a dream one. This kind of answers your question in a sideways way, but one of the things about the DFW Legacy Series that I continually try and keep in mind is I want to be able to look back at it. Like, let's say we're 5 years down the road or 10 years down the road. I want to look back and go, man, that catalog of those at that point will be 40 or 50 records. That catalog holistically represents that time period. We can't do everything, but if you go early 90s to kind of early 2000s, let's say around that 10 years. So who are the bands, speaking of wish lists, that aren't represented yet? Well, Tripping Daisy's not represented because, of course, they have good records. But maybe there's an opportunity there. And that I've had those discussions where it's like, man, Tripping Daisy deserves to be a part of the legacy because they are a part of the legacy series. So I would love to do a collaboration there. Toadie, certainly. Kirtland Records, they are still a very active band, but I'd love to do a collaboration there. Reverend Horton Heat, still an active artist. So there are some kind of pie in the sky artists that are still very active and successful and can put out their own records and are putting out their own records that I am still hopeful at some point to do some collaboration with, just because, again, I want them to exist within the series because they are a part of that legacy. So that's kind of like big picture for me. Toadie's Hell Below.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and I know I think that's rumored to be in the works for a long time now on their own part, which I'm just hopeful. I'm hopeful that it happens, period, whether we're not, if we would be involved, that'd be amazing. I don't think we would be, but that's an album that I think is very important and very sought after from a lot of people. And then, man, I don't. We've gotten a lot of the bands. I'd love to do some with old 97s. Similar. We had, so when we did the Adventure Club compilation with Josh, we had the old 97s were on that. Ben Queller was on that. Isley was on that. There's a lot of artists on that that, you know, they had one track on there.
Sure.
But I'd love to work on you know, full length releases or those types of things with that types of artists. It's a lot, you know, and that's not even getting into other genres. I'd love to do an Earl Harvin record.
Oh yeah.
Like, you know, there's stuff like that. You know, so and a lot of the kind of last beat genre type stuff, you know, there's lots.
Vibralux.
Yeah, there's lots of Rubber Bullet, lots of different bands and different corners to kind of navigate still.
We had Beth on an episode a while back, and it's so hard to believe that all the stuff that she's done, it goes back to, like I said, if you don't have it on that CD
or that
7-inch, you're not going to find it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember, because I try to look up the different artists and see if they're on iTunes, see, you know, where they are today, just yeah. So I can get a little better idea in my head of, okay, how does this band relate to today, mm-hmm. how they were back then? Yeah. I mean, because Rubber Bullet, Pinkston, they used to fill Trees. I mean, yeah. Trees was packed for those shows.
Mm-hmm.
And to realize now that somebody today who was not a part of that scene has no way to access it. It's just, it's a crime.
It's completely obscure. Yeah, there's no way. Even like YouTube, Google, like just the basics of where you would try to begin to find some of those artists. You're lucky if you find their name. The best you're going to find is like old Observer mentions.
Yep.
You know,
exactly.
That's the only thing you'll pull up on a lot of those is little snippets from Seen Heard,
yep.
You know, that they were playing Trees or whatever, but yeah.
Well, that's how it is with, I always enjoyed Ghost Hustler.
Mm-hmm.
They were a band out of Denton. I don't know if you remember them
or
not. I
remember the name.
Yeah, they had this little kind of blip on the scene, probably 2008, 2009-ish.
Oh, okay, later.
And eventually they broke up. And then the lead singer formed Neon Indian, which I'm sure you are familiar with, because they got pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
The Ghost Hustler stuff, they've got one 10-inch single listed on Discogs. They've got their one big kind of breakout video on YouTube. And then, like you said, there's some Observer articles that will show up. And that's it.
That's it.
And, you know, it's one of those bands, like a million others that you're saving, that could be lost to time otherwise.
Yeah, no. Yeah, and I thought of another one, speaking of wish list stuff. And this is someone we talk about often when we go back and forth. I'd love to work with Will in Centromatic.
Oh, sure, yeah.
We did Funland, which was unbelievable to be able to work on their record. And so I've been in touch with Will about maybe something Centromatic related, which would be phenomenal, because very little of that stuff exists on vinyl. And if it does, it's very hard to find. So that would be cool. Also, Slobberbone's another one.
Oh, sure,
Speaking
yeah.
of Denton, you know, and I know I have coordinated with Brent Best, and I think New West owns their catalog now, so I think a lot of that will eventually maybe see the light of day through New West, which would be amazing.
Everybody loves Barrel Chester. That was one of those albums that it's like, yeah. I mean, even Stephen King referenced that album.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, in all those conversations I have with all those different musicians, like, I legit tell them, I'm like, hey, we'd love to do this, but if we don't do it, that's cool too, but it needs to happen.
Sure.
You know, I have a lot of those conversations where it's like, oh, we're already talking with so-and-so. I'm like, that's great. When can I expect it? Because I know the reality of this stuff because of what we've already unpacked. There's not a lot of ability to profit here. So it takes someone who really cares and who really wants it to happen. Like, that's the thing in the vinyl community. You hear it all the time. It's like, why doesn't this album exist on vinyl? And the answer in most cases is because there's not a person out there who cares enough. That's really it. Sometimes it comes down to legalities, contracts. Most of the time, it just comes down to hustle and hard work and one person caring enough to make it happen. That's really all it is, because especially when you're talking about music that's 20, 30 years old, that is very niche. Like, again, not a lot of money to be made. So you got to have the right person to go after it for the good of the music versus the good of trying to make a buck. Two totally different things, you know, and most of my conversations I tell people, I'm like, hey, this deserves to be on my shelf. I want this on my shelf. Whether or not I make it happen or not, that's to be determined, but let's figure something out, you know?
But at least somebody's out there kind of stoking the fire. That's good.
Yeah. And it's fun to have those conversations, and it gets a little trickier when the artist is still active and they still have a career and they're looking out for their own bottom line, they make a living off this stuff. So, you know, you got to be mindful of that as well. With legacy artists that haven't been around for years, Paper Chase worked with John Congleton.
Sure, yeah.
That was a bucket list one. I loved Paper Chase. Again, early 2000s shows, man, they were on fire. Fry Street Fair shows, those were fun. A lot of shows with Baboon. That was really cool. And John was amazing to work with. I kind of expected him to be, not that he wasn't involved, but because he's a producer and a mixer. And
so big. I mean,
yeah, he's a big name, Grammy nominated. Yeah, I kind of thought, if I can figure out a way to get a hold of him, I'll probably never hear from him. It was the exact opposite. I routed through. He responded personally, was all for it, was very responsive and approving audio and art and all that. It was like one of the easier ones. I'm like, that's amazing. I just didn't expect it because he's a busy dude, you know?
Sure.
So that was a really cool one to work on. And there's a lot of them like that, man, that have just really surprised me that I've been able to have a hand in, because they were albums I had on CD,
you know,
in the early 90s and loved so much. And now to be able to drop a needle on them is really cool.
Well, if it hasn't already crossed your mind, hopefully Sorta is in there somewhere.
Yes, that's one that comes up a lot. Sorta, and what's the other band? There's another similar band that Carter was involved in.
Sparrows,
yeah. Those two. And I think there is representation on the Adventure Club comp of Sorta. I can't remember which one. But yeah, those have come up a lot as well. Again, speaking of legacy, definitely an artist that deserves to be a part of the series.
100%. With Trey now gone and Carter gone, it would be really nice to see something just to have that memory.
Agreed.
Well, again, I knew this was going to happen. We were going to blow way past time for our final song. And I could probably sit here and discuss this part for another 20 minutes easy. But I know we got to wrap up. Let me ask you this before we go. Do you ever see South FM taking the stage again? Because I know after you left, you moved on. They did have one more little kind of hurrah.
Yeah.
Are we going to see the band take the stage? Are we going to see the band re-released on vinyl?
So the band South FM is kind of still an active entity because Paco Estrada is still a very active songwriter, musician. And I think there is a record in the works. I'm not involved in it other than just being a fan and being supportive. They've got different musicians who have filled in. I did do a reunion show with South FM. It was about 2 years ago. We did a tree show with Nixon's and Dolly Braves, a DFW Legacy Series anniversary. I think it was our first anniversary party type of deal we did. So that was fun to be able to do. I don't know if I'll ever play with the band again, but I think South FM as an entity will probably still continue to live and breathe in some form over time, which I absolutely love, regardless of my involvement, because Paco is an amazing songwriter and person, and I support everything he does.
That's good. I think regardless, you being a founding member has your legacy kind of cemented there in the band. So
it is. I'm thankful for every moment of that and every mention of it, just to be able to cite something that I'm still proud of, and I think most importantly still stands up and is aged okay, which is you can't say about everything, you know, but I think our music I think it's still listenable, which excites me.
Definitely. All right, well let's finish out with a song. I think it makes the most sense to play out with something that's been released on the DFW Legacy series. What would you want to hear that you've got of those? You said 27.
Oh my
different
God, there's
albums.
So many. Let's finish with how about with one off the Funland Band?
Oh, that'll be great.
I love that record.
Definitely,
let's play
definitely.
One off the Funland Band.
Let's do
band.
That.
Great album.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time. I think it was a lot of fun. Like I said, I could probably do a whole nother episode or two just sitting here talking, because you've got so many stories. This was fun.
This was a blast, man. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity. Always fun to reminisce.
All right, so everyone, come back next time for another fun episode, and let's leave you with some Funland.